Welcome. My name is Divine. I am a fourth year medical student. This is the 20th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. Today we're going to continue with autonomic pharmacology. So let's get right into it. Okay, so one thing I forgot to mention at the last podcast where I talked about alpha-1 agents was high-yield use of prazosin. So prazosin is an alpha-1 blocker. It can actually be used to treat the flashbacks that accompany PTSD, post-traumatic and stress disorder. Remember your DSM-5, you need 1 month to make that diagnosis. If it's less than a month, that's acute stress disorder. Okay, so let's jump to the alpha-2 receptors. The alpha-2 receptors, they are GI-coupled receptors, okay? So they're inhibitory receptors, so they inhibit adenylate cyclase. So you ultimately get less activation of protein kinase A. And these receptors, it so happens that they are found on the presynaptic adrenergic receptor. So it's sort of a negative feedback system for the sympathetic nervous system. So let's talk about agonists, okay? So the goal of an agonist will be to help you release less norepinephrine, again, because it's a GI-coupled receptor. So the big drug I'll talk about here is clonidine, okay? Clonidine is an alpha-2 agonist. It's used to treat hypertension. It actually works extremely well. The only problem is once you stop the drug, you get rebound hypertension. And it's actually made a name nationally as a straight drug because it makes opioid withdrawal symptoms feel better, right? Because if you really think about this, opioids, their mechanism of action is to decrease the release of catecholamines like norepinephrine at the adrenergic synapse, right? So clonidine being an alpha-2 agonist also decreases the release of catecholamines at the adrenergic synapse. So that it basically works as an opioid. It just uses a slightly different mechanism, okay? So it will sort of temper the hyperadrenergic symptoms that accompany opioid withdrawal. Now, the next alpha-2 agonist I'll talk about is alpha-methyldopa. Okay, the big thing you want to know about this is it's an antihypertensive that is safe in pregnancy, okay? It's kind of big, so it doesn't cross the blood-placental barrier very well. Now, with regards to the alpha-2 antagonist, right? So if you're inhibiting an inhibitor, right? That will ultimately make you release more norepinephrine at the adrenergic synapse, right? So we know one of these diseases, according to the monoamine theory, that's associated with a decrease in norepinephrine. That's depression, right? So if you increase norepinephrine, you could potentially relieve symptoms. So that's the mechanism of action of a drug like mirtazapine. Mirtazapine is an antidepressant that works as an alpha-2 antagonist. Okay. It increases the release of norepinephrine at synapses, so it makes depression symptoms better. One big side effect you want to know is obesity with this drug. Okay, it spruces up a person's appetite. So it's probably a good choice on an exam in an anorexic patient that has depression. Or if they give you a question about an old lady that is not eating, that is sort of depressed, you can also give them mirtazapine. That'll be a nice agent for that. So now we're done with the alpha receptors. Let's jump to the beta receptors, okay? So we'll start with the beta 1 receptors. Remember, these are found in the heart, okay? They are positive. It's a receptor where if it's activated, you can increase heart rate, right? So positive chronotropy. You could also increase contractility. That's a positive inotropy. Okay, and the juxtaglomerular cells that comprise the afferent arteriole, if you activate beta 1 receptors at that spot, you increase the release of renin. Okay, so the first thing I want to establish here is that beta blockers, right? So beta blockers that start with the letters A through M, okay, M as in Mandy, okay, they're all beta 1 selective, but beta blockers that start from the letter N, like Nancy, through Z, they're beta 1 and 2, okay, so they are non-selective. In general, you want to avoid the non-selective beta blockers in asthmatics, because remember, if you block beta 2 receptors, you'll cause bronchoconstriction, and that can trigger airway compromise. So the beta 1 selective blockers, right? So we have drugs like atenolol, okay? Esmolol, propranolol is non-selective, okay? And one other thing I will say with these beta blockers, there's 3 beta blockers that have been shown to improve survival in heart failure or improve survival in like an ischemic cardiomyopathy after a person has a myocardial infarction. Okay, the easy way to remember them is just remember biochemistry, like the B, the C, and the M in biochemistry. Okay, so the drugs here are bisoprolol. Okay, there is carvedilol, it's an alpha beta blocker, and then there is metoprolol, which is it's also a beta 1 selective agent. Okay, so these drugs, they improve survival, they actually slow down remodeling of the heart, because norepinephrine, it can actually induce a cardiac remodeling that can make a person's heart failure worse. But one thing you want to remember is, yes, these drugs are good for heart failure, but you do not want to give a beta blocker in the setting of an acute heart failure exacerbation, right? Because you don't want to cardio depress these people even more. You also probably want to avoid a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker under this scenario. Okay, now some other words with the beta blockers, right? So carvedilol, labetalol, they are alpha beta blockers. One special thing you want to know about labetalol is that it is in fact safe in pregnancy, okay? Remember that mnemonic for the drugs that are safe in pregnancy, the antihypertensives that are safe in pregnancy. The mnemonic here is hypertensive moms love nifedipine, okay? So the H stands for hydralazine. The M stands for alpha-methyl-DOPA, okay? The L stands for labetalol, and the N stands for nifedipine, okay? So, labetalol is safe in pregnancy. Another good thing about labetalol is that it's a great drug that can be given in a hypertensive emergency, okay? There are some other drugs you could also give, drugs like nitroprusside. Be careful with your cyanide toxicity with that. And you can also give like nifedipine or nicardipine, okay? And carvedilol, labetalol, they're also nice drugs that you can give in the setting of a cocaine overdose, okay? Because you don't want to have the unopposed alpha-1 vasoconstrictive effect that can cause hypertension. So you can give labetalol under those circumstances. Although the first-line drug for the treatment of a cocaine overdose or cocaine intoxication, if a person is severely hypertensive, is a benzodiazepine, right? So like lorazepam or diazepam or anything like that. Now, another special set of beta blockers, we have acebutolol and pindolol, okay? These drugs are partial beta agonists, okay? So yes, they're agonists, but they have partial activity, so they in fact present with beta blocking actions, okay? Because if you think about it, if you had norepinephrine around, you will get the full effect from activating that receptor, okay? So drugs like acebutolol and pindolol, by taking over those receptors, they are giving you less than a full effect. So they're basically exerting an antagonist effect, if you may. Okay. So again, think of those drugs as partial beta agonists, but they are classically described as being beta blockers. Now, another special beta blocker here is nebivolol, okay? One special thing about nebivolol is it actually increases the release of nitric oxide in endothelial cells, okay? And remember, nitric oxide is a potent vasodilator, okay? So it can actually lower your total peripheral resistance. So an unusual step one question will be a patient that should avoid... they could give you like some extra drugs and say, oh, which of the following is contraindicated with nebivolol administration, right? You want to, again, avoid other drugs that can severely lower your total peripheral resistance, like sildenafil. Remember, it's a PDE5 inhibitor that's used to treat pulmonary hypertension, and it's also used to treat the erectile dysfunction. And you also probably want to avoid this in a person that's taking a nitrate. Okay. Now, beta blockers, they do act as class 2 antiarrhythmics, right? So you can use them in AFib, okay? Remember, AFib classically shows up on exams as an arrhythmia that has an irregular interval, okay? You can also use beta blockers for an SVT, right? So supraventricular tachycardia. Remember, again, the classic description of this kind of arrhythmia is a narrow, complex, regular tachyarrhythmia, okay? So it's originating above the AV node, right? So you have very narrow QRS complexes with that. You can also use beta blockers in heart failure, okay? So they do decrease myocardial oxygen demand because they somewhat cardio-depress the heart, okay? And by slowing down the heart, right, they increase the diastolic filling time. So your end diastolic volume actually increases, so you could potentially take advantage of the Frank-Starling relationship. And it also, again, because the antiarrhythmics, they decrease the risk of dangerous arrhythmias that could cause death. Okay. Alternatively, you could also use beta blockers in the setting of a thyroid storm. Okay. Usually you resort to non-selective beta blockers like propranolol. Okay. The first thing propranolol does is it dumbs down the hyperadrenergic state that accompanies a thyroid storm. But in addition, it inhibits an enzyme known as the 5' deiodinase. The 5' deiodinase converts T4 to T3. Okay. So by inhibiting that 5' deiodinase, you decrease the formation of T3. Okay, which again can dumb down the responses of your body in the setting of a thyroid storm. Other things you can use in a thyroid storm besides propranolol, right? You also want to use PTU, right? So PTU, propyl thiouracil, it inhibits thyroperoxidase, okay, which is the rate limiting enzyme of thyroid hormone synthesis, but it also inhibits the 5' deiodinase that converts T4 to T3. Okay, PTU, one quick thing I'll just slot in here is that it's actually the preferred anti-thyroid medication in the first trimester of pregnancy. Okay, but once you get to the second or third trimesters, you want to switch to methimazole because PTU has nasty hepatotoxicity that you'd want to avoid. Okay, so in a thyroid storm, you can also give steroids. Okay, so steroids also inhibit the magic 5' deiodinase that converts T4 to T3. But in addition to that, steroids can also spruce up your adrenal axis, right? Because there's been some reports that show that people that are in thyroid storm actually have some kind of adrenal suppression. Another use for beta blockers, you can actually use them in the setting of esophageal varices. Okay, use them for prophylactic treatment in esophageal varices. You don't necessarily use them under acute circumstances. If a person is having an acute variceal bleed, the first line drug you give is octreotide. Okay, no one really knows how octreotide works for this purpose, but studies have shown that it reduces splanchnic blood flow. Okay, but if you want to prophylax in the long term against esophageal varices, you want to go ahead and give a non-selective beta blocker like propranolol. Other things you can use for the prophylactic treatment of esophageal varices, right? So you can give spironolactone. Okay, spironolactone is an aldosterone receptor antagonist. Okay, it does reduce portal pressures, and in general, there's an antibiotic you usually add on in patients that have a history of esophageal varices as prophylaxis against something known as spontaneous bacterial peritonitis, which actually has a pretty high mortality rate. The classic antibiotics that are administered are fluoroquinolones, right? So you can give like norfloxacin or ofloxacin or ciprofloxacin. Okay, they are good prophylaxis against spontaneous bacterial peritonitis. Now, if a person overdoses on a beta blocker, how do you rescue those people? You rescue them with glucagon, right? So what's the mechanism behind that? The thing is, if a person takes a beta blocker, right? So beta 1 receptors, for example, are GS coupled, right? So when you block them, you have low levels of cyclic AMP. So if a person has beta blocker toxicity, what you try to do is you're like, okay, wait, a beta blocker dumps down cyclic AMP. Let me try to raise that person's cyclic AMP in a different fashion. Okay, so you could potentially give an agent that has activating activity, if you may, at a GS coupled receptor, right? That GS coupled receptor will increase the activity of adenylate cyclase and increase the conversion of ATP to cyclic AMP. Okay, so it so happens that glucagon works through a GS coupled receptor, so it can raise your cyclic AMP through a different receptor as compared with the beta receptor that has already been blocked with a beta blocker. Another useful thing you should also think about with glucagon is you can actually use it as a rescue agent in severe hypoglycemia. It raises a person's blood glucose really fast. Another thing you could also use glucagon for, but this is more for third year, is if a person has something stuck in their esophagus, the administration of glucagon can actually cause it can cause smooth muscle relaxation in the esophagus transiently, and that can help that item pass. Okay, and that's one of those bizarre things that may just pop up on an exam out of the blue. And another high yield thing with glucagon is a glucagonoma, right? So a glucagonoma, right, as the term says, right? It's a tumor that secretes glucagon. It's classically associated on exams with MEN1 syndrome. Okay, remembering MEN1, you have parathyroid problems, you have pancreatic problems like a glucagonoma, and you also have pituitary problems, classically a pituitary adenoma that secretes prolactin. So glucagonoma, the classic thing you want to know with that is these patients classically have diabetes, okay, because remember, glucagon's job is to raise your blood glucose levels, and they also have a skin rash, right? So the skin rash is classically termed on exams as a necrolytic migratory erythema. Okay, so again, remember the association on MEN1. So if you get an exam question about a person that has new onset diabetes and they have a skin rash, okay, and they potentially give you like hypercalcemia from a parathyroid problem, think about a glucagonoma with that. That's probably the first thing your mind should jump to on an exam. Now, let's go on to the beta 1 receptor agonists, okay? The big one I'll talk about here is dobutamine, okay? You can give it in the setting of a CHF exacerbation, right? Because in those cases, the heart is not pumping very well, right? So by activating those beta 1 receptors, you provide some positive inotropy to the heart, okay? You could potentially get that person over the hump of an acute CHF exacerbation. You could actually also use dobutamine for cardiac stress test, okay? So if a patient cannot go on a treadmill, you can try to stress out the heart pharmacologically by giving a beta 1 agonist like dobutamine, okay? Now, a quick detour here. You can use dobutamine for a pharmacologic stress test, but another thing you could actually take advantage of is a principle known as the coronary steel principle, okay? The coronary steel principle. And it also takes advantage of pharmacology. They use a different kind of pharmacology to stress out the heart or to induce ischemia, if you may. So what's the coronary steel principle? In the coronary steel principle, when a person has a thrombus, right? So let's say they have a thrombus that's largely occluding one of their coronary vessels. The body tries to respond by maximally dilating that vessel, okay? Now, the thing is, that vessel that's maximally dilated, it's great, right? It's helping you provide more perfusion to that ischemic region of the heart. But that vessel that has been maximally dilated essentially loses its response to the administration of a vasodilator, okay? So that vessel, maximally dilated, you give a vasodilator like cilostazol or dipyridamole, for example. That vessel would not have the ability to dilate any further, right? Because, I mean, if you sort of think about it teleologically, you don't want that person's blood vessel to, that coronary vessel to pop, okay? So, if that vessel is maximally dilated and you give a coronary vasodilator like dipyridamole, it's a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. I believe I talked about that in a previous podcast on hematologic pharmacology. Or cilostazol, which is also a phosphodiesterase inhibitor, okay? Or regadenoson. Regadenoson is an adenosine analog. Remember, adenosine is a very powerful coronary vasodilator, okay? So if you give these drugs, okay, you dilate all the other normal coronary vessels, but you will not be able to dilate the stenosed vessel. And when the other coronary vessels are dilated, you will increase blood flow through those vessels. And if you sort of think about it this way, if you're increasing blood flow through those vessels are effectively stealing blood away from the stenosed vessel because the resistance in those newly dilated vessels from the administration of the vasodilator causes more blood flow through them, okay? So because you're ultimately having less blood flow through the stenosed vessel, you begin to induce ischemic symptoms in the region of the heart that is supplied by those stenosed vessels. That's the principle behind the coronary steel, or I guess the physiology behind the coronary steel principle, okay? This is probably a rare scenario, but a weird thing they can give on an exam potentially is to say, oh, what if a person has like three coronary vessels and all of them are stenosed and maximally dilated? You would not have a positive coronary steel test with those people, right? Because all those vessels are all dilated. But that would be a super, super, super unusual scenario. As long as there is differential stenosis of coronary vessels, you would almost certainly have inducible ischemia with the administration of a vasodilator when you're trying to apply the coronary steel principle. Now, next drug I'll jump to here is isoproterenol. Isoproterenol is a beta-1 and 2 agonist, okay? It decreases systemic vascular resistance, right? Because by activating beta-2 receptors, you increase the synthesis of cyclic AMP, you cause smooth muscle relaxation, and you cause a vasodilation. But it also increases cardiac output, okay, because it's a beta-1 activator, okay? So one very nice thing they love to do on these USMLE exams is to try to test your knowledge of cardiovascular parameters like blood pressure and systolic blood pressure and diastolic blood pressure and pulse pressure and all that fun stuff when you administer certain cardioactive agents. I'll talk about that with Myorinone in a few minutes. Okay, so isoproterenol increases cardiac output because it's a beta-1 agonist, but it also decreases your total peripheral resistance because it's a beta-2 agonist. Now, for the beta-2 agents, remember again, your beta-2 receptors, they're GS-coupled, so they increase cyclic AMP, so they cause smooth muscle relaxation, right? So you could potentially use your beta-2 agonists in the treatment of asthma, okay? So those are your terol drugs, right? So like albuterol, salmeterol, formoterol. Albuterol is a short-acting beta-2 agonist, okay? Salmeterol and formoterol are long-acting beta-2 agonists. Okay, you could also use these drugs to relax the smooth muscle in the uterus, right? So like the myometrium. You can use drugs like Ritodrine, R-I-T-O-D-R-I-N-E, or Tributyline. Okay, these are both beta-2 agonists that can relax the myometrium of the uterus. Okay, you could use them as tocolytics, right? So if you want to delay delivery, right, by stopping contractions for like 24 to 48 hours, you can use a beta-2 agonist like Ritodrine or Tributyline for that purpose. Now, one other thing you want to keep track of is that when you activate beta receptors around the ciliary body of the eye, you actually increase the synthesis of aqueous humor, right? So if a person has a disorder like glaucoma, where they have increased intraocular pressures from too much aqueous humor, you potentially want to give something that blocks those beta receptors, okay? So you want to give a beta blocker like acebutolol or pindolol or nidolol or timolol, okay? These are all beta blockers that by blocking those beta receptors that you find around the ciliary body, you do in fact decrease the synthesis of aqueous humor. You could also treat glaucoma with an alpha-2 agonist, right? Because, again, let's reason through this physiologically. If you activate an alpha-2 receptor, you release less norepinephrine. And by releasing less norepinephrine, you release less of an activator of the beta receptors on the ciliary body. So you ultimately make less aqueous humor. That's how drugs like apraclonidine and brimonidine work, okay? They're alpha-2 agonists that can be used to treat glaucoma. Now, let's take a small detour and talk about Myorinone, okay? Myorinone. So Myorinone is a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. It's classically used in ICUs. It's a phosphodiesterase 3 inhibitor, okay? And remember that the job of phosphodiesterase is to break down cyclic AMP to AMP, okay? So you're basically inactivating cyclic AMP. So if you inhibited phosphodiesterase, you would have less breakdown of cyclic AMP. And like we said, cyclic AMP does different things depending on the kind of muscle we're concerned with. So if you're dealing with cardiac muscle, cyclic AMP leads to the activation of protein kinase A, okay? And when protein kinase A is activated, it phosphorylates phospholamban, okay? And when phospholamban is phosphorylated, it becomes inactive. Okay, so by inactivating phospholamban, you have less inhibition of a circa pump. Okay, the circa pump is something that actively brings calcium into the sarcoplasmic reticulum of cardiac muscle. So phospholamban inhibits the circa pump. Okay, so if you phosphorylate phospholamban with protein kinase A under the activity of cyclic AMP, phospholamban becomes inactive. Okay, your circa pump becomes active, you put more calcium in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and as more calcium goes into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, more calcium can also be released, which can ultimately aid in the contraction of cardiac muscle. Okay, so Myorinone, by inhibiting phosphodiesterase 3, boosts cyclic AMP levels in cardiac muscle and causes cardiac muscle contraction. Okay, but in smooth muscle, when you inhibit phosphodiesterase, you increase your levels of cyclic AMP, you actually have an inhibition of myosin light chain kinase. Okay, myosin light chain kinase. And when myosin light chain kinase is inactivated, okay, you have less phosphorylation of your actin and myosin filaments, okay, and that causes smooth muscle relaxation. So the big takeaway here is high levels of cyclic AMP increase contraction of cardiac muscle. High levels of cyclic AMP cause relaxation of smooth muscle. So let's talk about some cardiovascular parameters in the context of male renal. Okay, so male renal, we know it increases cyclic AMP, right? So if you understood the spiel I just went on for the last like 2 minutes, you should be able to answer all these questions. So what should cardiac output, what should happen to cardiac output if a patient is placed on male renal? It should increase, right? Because again, your cardiac contractility is going up. Now, what should happen to your end diastolic volume? What do you think? What should happen to your end diastolic volume? Well, I hope you're saying nothing, okay? Because your end diastolic volume really has nothing to do with contractility, okay? So your end diastolic volume basically stays the same with murinone administration. Now, what happens to your end systolic volume? Well, it should decrease, right? Because when you have better contractility of the heart, your stroke volume increases, right? And if your stroke volume increases, the volume of blood that's left in the heart at the end of systole or contraction, which is your end systolic volume, should go down, okay? So if your heart contractility is increasing, what's happening to your stroke volume on male renal? It should go up, right? And if your stroke volume is increasing, what should happen to your systolic blood pressure on male renal? It should increase as well, right? Because remember, your cardiac output is a proxy for your systolic blood pressure. If your cardiac output increases, your systolic blood pressure increases, okay? Your cardiac output is the primary determinant of your systolic blood pressure, okay? Contrast that with systemic vascular resistance that is a determinant of your diastolic blood pressure, okay? So, murinone increases your cardiac output because it increases cardiac contractility. So, it does, in fact, increase your systolic blood pressure, okay? Now, what does murinone do to the systemic vascular resistance, right? So, work with me here. Your cyclic AMP levels go up in smooth muscle. Smooth muscle constitutes your blood vessels, right? So you should have a decrease in your systemic vascular resistance, right? And if your systemic vascular resistance is going down, what should then happen to your diastolic blood pressure? It should go down as well, right? So we've already deduced that male renal increases systolic blood pressure and decreases your diastolic blood pressure. So if murinone is increasing your SBP and decreasing your DBP, what should happen to your pulse pressure? It should become wider. It should increase, right? Remember, pulse pressure is the difference between the systolic and the diastolic blood pressure, okay? So your pulse pressure widens or increases in the setting of murinone administration, okay? And again, don't forget, again, murinone, by decreasing your SVR, your afterload is going down, your inotropy is going up, again, because it's improving our cardiac contractility. Okay, so let's keep going. So I will say we are basically done with the sympathetic agent. So let's go ahead and jump to the parasympathetic agents. Okay, the parasympathetic agents. So the first thing I will say is if you want to synthesize acetylcholine at a cholinergic synapse, okay, the first thing that happens is that sodium, right? Remember, sodium is primarily an extracellular ion. So as it goes down its gradient into a cell, you can use that gradient energy to pump things against their concentration gradient. So how is this relevant to our acetylcholine synthesis story? Its relevance here is that the first step in the synthesis of acetylcholine is that sodium, as it goes down its gradient into a neuron, it can also drag choline alongside, okay? So there's a sodium-choline symporter that brings choline into the cell, okay? There's a drug known as hemicholinium that inhibits that transporter. The next thing that happens is that the choline combines with acetyl-CoA, okay, under the action of choline acetyltransferase or CHAT to make acetylcholine, okay? And then that acetylcholine is ultimately packaged into vesicles, okay? There's a transporter that actually makes that happen. That transporter can be inhibited by a drug known as vesamecol, okay? Vesamecol, vesicle inhibitor, if you may. And then as an action potential travels down that neuron, right, you change the voltage of the neuron, okay? And as you change that voltage, a voltage-gated calcium channel opens. Remember, that's the channel that's blocked by autoantibodies in the setting of Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome. Okay, so calcium comes into the cell, okay, and that triggers the exocytosis of acetylcholine at the synapse from vesicles, okay. Now, the turn-off mechanism for acetylcholine, right, is acetylcholinesterase, right? So acetylcholinesterase can break down acetylcholine into choline and acetate, right? So you can repeat the cycle all over again. Now, some high-yield pathological integrations here. First is botulism, okay? So remember, the botulinum toxin cleaves the snare proteins, like your V and T snares, that help you bring the vesicles to the membrane of the neuron to cause exocytosis and release of neurotransmitters. So the botulinum toxin, its mechanism of action is it cleaves those snare proteins, okay? And by doing that, you decrease the release of acetylcholine, okay? So how do people get botulism, right? So there are two ways you can get botulism. They love to test this on exams to see if you can differentiate between how a neonate gets botulism and how an adult gets botulism. So how does a neonate get botulism? They contract botulism if, for example, they take honey. Okay, so that's why pediatricians say, oh, don't give your kids that are less than a year old honey, right? Because honey can contain botulinum spores, okay? And those spores, they can actually germinate in the GI tract of neonates, because neonates, they don't have a very robust GI flora, so those spores can germinate, okay? As those spores germinate, they release the botulinum toxin, and then that can cause a lot of trouble for the neonate, like flaccid paralysis, if you may. But an adult has a robust GI flora, okay? So in general, botulinum spores cannot germinate in the GI tract of an adult. So how does an adult get botulism? They can get botulism if they consume the preformed toxin, not the spores, the preformed toxin, okay? And the classic exam scenario here is when an adult consumes home canned goods, okay? They can get botulism with that, okay? And again, remember, ultimately with botulism, you have decreased release of acetylcholine at the cholinergic synapse, so you get flaccid paralysis. Okay. Another pathological integration here is myasthenia gravis. Okay. In myasthenia gravis, you essentially form autoantibodies against the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. Okay. Just think of primarily acetylcholine receptors. And when you make those autoantibodies, right, acetylcholine cannot bind anymore. Okay. Because again, you're making a competitive inhibitor of its receptor. And if you really think about that, they can actually test that very easily in the context of Michaelis-Menten kinetics, okay? So if a person has myasthenia gravis, right, their acetylcholine receptors are operating under competitive inhibition physiology, right? So under those circumstances, your Vmax does not necessarily change, but your Km goes up, so that signals decreased affinity of acetylcholine for the acetylcholine receptor. And in myasthenia gravis, right, the classic testing, I'll say right now, like clinically, the first line test in the diagnosis of myasthenia gravis is to get anti-acetylcholine receptor antibodies, okay? But occasionally on exams, you'll hear about the tensillin test, okay? How does the tensillin test work? The tensillin test is basically a test that involves the administration of a drug known as edrofonium, okay? Edrofonium is an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor. Okay, so when you administer edrofonium, you inhibit acetylcholinesterase, your levels of acetylcholine build up, and those can outcompete the autoantibodies that are parked on the surface of the acetylcholine receptor. Okay, so edrofonium will improve the symptoms of myasthenia gravis transiently. It's a short-acting acetylcholinesterase inhibitor. So most times for myasthenia gravis, you just go ahead and give pyridostigmine. Pyridostigmine is a longer-acting acetylcholinesterase inhibitor that also has the ability to cross the blood-brain barrier. Now, one weird thing they can do on the USMLEs is to say that, wait, a person has flaccid paralysis, right? They have like a myasthenic presentation, but you administer edrofonium and those people's symptoms fail to improve. What could be the reasoning behind that? I'll let you think for a second. So think more upstream. What's the rate limiting? What's the enzyme that helps you synthesize acetylcholine? Right, that's CHAT, okay? Choline acetyltransferase. If you have a CHAT deficiency, you will never be able to make acetylcholine. If you don't make acetylcholine, there is nothing that you can put in the cholinergic synapse that you could try to boost levels of by inhibiting acetylcholinesterase, okay? So if you get a question about a person that has a myasthenic presentation, okay, but their symptoms do not improve with the administration of erythropoietin, the very first thing you probably want to think about on the exam is a CHAT deficiency or choline acetyltransferase deficiency. Okay, so another thing that ties in with the inhibition of acetylcholinesterase is organophosphate poisoning. Okay, so they may frame this as a bioterrorism question, or they may frame this as a question about a kid that played in a farm that was recently sprayed with pesticides, because pesticides, a lot of them contain organophosphates. Organophosphates, they inhibit acetylcholinesterase, right? So by inhibiting acetylcholinesterase, you have a very high buildup of acetylcholine, and that can cause a cholinergic toxidrome, okay? So a person will be like hypotensive, they'll be bradycardic, because remember, acetylcholine slows conduction through the AV node. If you have enough slowing of conduction through the AV node, you can actually have like a heart block, okay? Those people will sweat a lot, because remember, your sweat glands are responsive to acetylcholine through muscarinic receptors, although remember that that entire system is under the control of your sympathetic nervous system, right? Remember, that's one of those oddities about the sympathetic nervous system, where it actually works with acetylcholine through muscarinic receptors. Now, you could also have like urination, right? Because your parasympathetic nervous system wants you to urinate. You could have like fecal incontinence. You could have lacrimation. So like these people are like leaky from everywhere. If you see that, think about a cholinergic toxidrome, okay? Another thing that can cause that cholinergic toxidrome is nerve gas, right? So like sarin. Sarin works by inhibiting acetylcholinesterase, right? So real quick, how do you treat a cholinergic toxidrome? Right, you treat a cholinergic toxidrome by giving something that blocks muscarinic receptors, right? So you can give a drug like atropine. Atropine is a muscarinic receptor antagonist that can be used in the acute treatment, or I guess as a rescue agent in a cholinergic toxidrome. In addition, you also want to give a drug like prelidoxime. Prelidoxime helps you regenerate. It's in the hospital. I believe it's known as TUPAM. It helps you regenerate acetylcholinesterase, right? So that you can break down that excess acetylcholine, right? Because there is not many... I should probably not talk about this. I have some ideas in my head about nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, but that's more anesthesia domain. So I think I'll just sort of let go of that. I'll make some mention of that when we get to anesthesia pharmacology. I'll make a podcast on that. Okay. So I think we should probably go ahead and stop here. I will continue autonomic pharmacology in our next podcast, and we'll just go through it step by step. If you listen to all these podcasts, you should become an expert in autonomic pharmacology by the end, and you should you'll probably know all you need for your USMLE exams. So I wish you all the best. Have a wonderful evening, and God bless. Thank you.